What's my name?
Mitzvah.
What's my name?
Mitzvah.
What's my name?
Mitzvah.
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today I have another special guest that has written some books, and I think it's just really in this parenting teaching space. I'm excited to introduce you to her. I'll let her introduce herself, and then we'll jump into the conversation. Go ahead.
All right. Hi, Chaz. I'm glad you're having me on. I'm Hunter Clark Fields. I'm the creator of the Mindful Parenting Course, host of the Mindful Mama podcast, and author of Raising Good Humans. And the new book is Raising Good Humans Every Day. Yay!
So you are here promoting a new book. You had Raising Good Humans, and now you have, which I have as well, and now you have Raising Good Humans Every Day. Can you tell us a little bit about your first book, and then what makes this book different from the first book? Because similar title, Raising Good Humans, Raising Good Humans Every Day, is just a two-word difference. What was the first book about? And then what is the difference? Why are you writing another one?
Well, both of the books come from they all come out of the fact that I was like really struggling as a parent. Like I was not naturally gifted at this. I really kind of sucked, I would say. I was like, I really had high aspirations for how I wanted to parent my kids. And then I found that I had this like intense temper, you know, that I got from my dad. I had a real temper. I was yelling at my daughter. I could see I was scaring her, all this stuff. And I really felt like, oh, this is exactly how I didn't want a parent. So I really kind of put myself through this intensive time of learning, and I continue to learn, you know, tools and development and things like that. And what I put into Raising Good Humans, the first book. So I will answer the question about why the books are different, but the first book is really about the two sort of essential tools that I realized you needed, because I was learning from these great parenting coaches and people who would like have great advice that I like simply could not implement when I was starting to lose it. Like it would all go out the window, like, and I would just yell again. And then I'd feel even worse. I'd feel more guilty because then I knew what I should have done. And then I yelled anyway. And I was like, oh my God, I suck. So I realized that into this parenting world, all these sort of tools that I had been learning sort of slowly and steadily, in which I started to ramp up my learning from the mindfulness world, really needed to come into the parenting world. And so Raising Good Humans is about the tools of mindfulness that help us to calm our reactivity so that we can use our whole brain. And then what to say to our kids. So it's about mindfulness and skillful communication. It really hones in on that. And then in Raising Good Humans Every Day, it's 50 short chapters. You can dive into it at any point. I really get to expand upon what I did in Raising Good Humans. And I talk about skillful communication and mindfulness, but I also get to talk about like our home environment and our schedules and all these kind of tips and tools, because I've been doing the Mindful Mama podcast now for 10 years. So I've learned all these different things from so many guests. And so I got to put it all into these like 50 short chapters that you can, you know, that are kind of translate all this, like all this knowledge into like really bite-sized actionable ways to kind of bring it home.
So the first book is like your aha moment, your realization of like, oh, wow, I need these two tools of just being mindful and using skillful communication. And then your second, your current book right now, that Raising Good Humans Every Day, is diving deeper into like the practical application, what that really looks like and sounds like in all these different kinds of situations is what it is. Is that about right?
Yeah. And, you know, there are things like, you know, how do I make them stop? There's a chapter about being playful. There's a chapter about our schedules. There's a chapter about conflict resolution, a chapter about, you know, taking breaks and downtime for everything. And it's all like you read 3 or 4 pages and you're done with a chapter. So that whole idea is like, I know you parents, you don't have time to be reading this 500 page tome. Like, yeah. I get it, right? So I want to give you the information in these bite-sized pieces.
Okay, can we dive into a few of those topics?
Sure.
Something you said, conflict resolution. Can you give us some bite-sized, or maybe you have a story, or give us some bite-sized kind of tools or information about how do we do conflict resolution when you got, you know, maybe siblings who are constantly in conflict. And then there's also that mindfulness piece there too, for sure, because that can be very triggering for us. And then we come in and then we need someone to do conflict resolution with us.
No kidding.
So what are some bite-sized, like, give us some tips around conflict resolution with kids?
Well, I mean, when I think of, well, you know, mentioning that chapter on conflict resolution, I started with this story, like, when, because basically I talk about when I was little, and maybe it's like when you were little. So when I was little, my brother was 2.5 years older than me. We fought all the time, as we would, you know, kids would do. And my parents would just feel super frustrated, and they would just yell at us to, like, go to your room, right? Like, we would stop fighting, go to your room. Or if I had a conflict with my dad, he would, you know, ground me, or even worse, like, he would spank me or something like that. He would use fear tactics and things like that. And basically when with those conflict resolution strategies, I didn't learn anything. You know, I basically learned how to, like, arm myself better for a conflict, to feel sad for myself, to, like, have better defense mechanisms, that kind of stuff. Like, I didn't really, all I learned was, like, the one who has the most power is going to win in this situation. And that's not very effective conflict resolution, right? So, in, you know, when I talk about conflict resolution, I think the thing that is helpful to just is, like, we need to kind of shift our mindset about conflict resolution and think about, like, well, when we have a conflict, one party has some needs, the other party has some other needs, right? And we have for most instances, we have a conflict of needs, right? Like, my needs for whatever to, like, play over here are interfering with your needs to whatever your needs are, right? Like, and we all have varied needs for, like, autonomy and play and calm and quiet and stimulation and all kinds of different things, right? So if we can then say, instead of, like, the old school way was like, we have these, you know, you do this and get out of my way and that'll solve my problem. But if instead we can say, what do you need? This is what I'm needing. This is, what are you needing? How can we get everyone's needs met? That's really, like, just a paradigm shifting way of seeing it, because then we're getting beneath the layer of solutions. Cause, you know, there's many, many solutions once we look at it this way. Like, if we say, you know, how can we meet your needs, rather than my solution is in conflict with your solution. There can be lots of different solutions to it. So it's really about shifting that mindset to say, how can we, it's like win-win instead of win-lose. Like, the old school ways are like, I'm going to win and therefore you're going to lose. But what if we can both get our needs met? Then that's actually a much more skillful way of teaching our kids to resolve conflicts, like, for the future and everything they'll do in their life anyway.
Yeah. So, but how do you go about actually you know, I hear that it's we both have needs, and, you know, maybe your need is to, you really want that, you know, toy that someone else is playing with, or they're doing something you really want it to, but they're playing with it at the moment. And it's so hard for you to have, you know, especially as a young child, so hard to have the impulse control not to grab it, or just use that physical force to try to get it. And, you know, the person who has a toy may have the need to finish playing what they're playing and finish out that idea that they had within their play and finish out the story, whatever that is. How do you go about actually you know, communicating those needs. But a lot of times we come in this situation and it's, you know, it's already happened. It'd be great if we can
catch
it proactively, but more times than not, we're probably catching it. Someone's been hit. Someone's been, four or five things have already happened.
Yeah.
No, and you got to almost kind of like uncover all of the things. So when you approach, you know, two children who've just kind of had this, you know, and it could be, you use whatever example you want. It could be a retort or whatever. How do you approach and kind of get to the part where we're understanding each other's needs and then, you know, maybe communicating them, understanding them, and then getting them, like, what does that actually sound like in your world?
Yeah. That sounds pretty highfalutin, right? If you're talking about two toddlers who are fighting over a toy. I mean, yeah, there's some tools that we can go into this. And like, when we're thinking about like conflicts like that, we kind of have to like triage a situation, right? Like there's certain different levels. Like if your kids are fighting and nobody's going to get hurt, then that's a great place to actually just kind of step back and just like bite your tongue and be like, my kids are practicing conflict resolution. I'm going to go hide in the bathroom and not interfere. You know, like I'm just going to step back, and that's okay. Right. And that's actually can be really skillful. Like you don't need to get involved and solve all their problems. It's good for them to solve their problems, even if they don't do it skillfully, which they probably won't because they're immature. That's fine. Like, just let them have their moments where you're not judge and jury and just doing all the things, right? But then if things are heating up and you think someone's about to get hurt, this is when we can go in and actually we can use a tool, a mindfulness tool, kind of right away. And what a mindfulness tool that we use is, in mindfulness world, we call it noting, but it's just the idea of just acknowledging and describing what's happening rather than going in judgmentally, right? So in the mindfulness world, we have these attitudes of kindness and curiosity, and curiosity is the opposite of judgment, right? So we want to just come in and non-judgmentally describe what's happening. Like, whoa, there's a lot of noise going on here. Looks like you really want this. Looks like you want to finish playing with it, but you're upset that this is that. Do I have this right? Like, so you might start to, rather than solve your kids' problems, you might go in and kind of be if things are starting to heat up, an intermediary person, you know, like, you know, where you can kind of help your kids translate their language to each other, their unskillful language to each other in a skillful way, where you can say, okay, looks like you want this. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. You want this. Okay. This is what's happening. I wonder how we can solve this problem. And you don't even have to have all the answers yourself, right? You can just put it out there. I wonder how we can solve this problem. You know, it looks like you need this. Looks like you need this. So you're going to kind of translate what's happening for your kids into needs. And that way, as they grow up with that, eventually that's going to sink in, right? Like that they're going to understand that this is how we resolve conflicts. This is what I need. This is what you need. If it's gotten to a point where like somebody has gotten hurt or is really, like it's really heated up, you've got kind of a code red situation here, then you might say, whoa, everybody's, you know, again, just describe, everybody's really upset. I can see you're super mad. I could see you're really upset. I don't think we are able to talk about this right now because everybody is so upset. I think we all need some time to chill out so that we can figure this out, you know, and then we might need to like separate a little bit, or, you know, this is where we want to think about like the neurobiology of like our emotions, right? Because we can't, that the whole idea of like of the tools of mindfulness are the tools that help us to regulate our, you know, our emotional response, our stress response system. And when we get to a point where the emotions are just so heated, there's not a lot of thinking happening, right? Like if you can, like you're just flooded by emotion, you can't think. So when we can see that, or when we want to get in the practice of noticing when emotions are flooded, whether it's ourselves, whether it's our kids or whatever, if the emotions have gotten so hot, that's not the time to resolve a conflict. We can't think, right? So we need to then take care of those emotions. So it might be like, you know, who needs a hug? You know, who needs to go punch a pillow? You know, whatever, right? We have to kind of address the emotions first But so yeah, so that's kind of like your two, your sort of like green light for, or maybe it's like green light, you let your kids resolve the problem, go away. Yellow light, go in and do some non-judgmental describing and translating. And then red light, just like it's all just emotional regulation.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I like those little lights. How do you, okay. So how do you really notice when, for you, what you've noticed or what you've heard or seen or whatever, what is the signal that helps you kind of identify the difference between green light and yellow light, right? Because you said sometimes, hide in a bathroom, let them solve their problems their own, or let them try to. But sometimes go in and intervene. How do you know when to intervene? What are some signals that like, oh, okay, actually might need to intervene in this one, or like, oh, actually maybe I just need to take a step back. What are some of those maybe cues or some things that you would signal you to identify that?
I mean, I think that's a good question. And I think that's really individual to like everybody and their kids, right? It's like, this is where you can then come to this idea of like attunement with your kids and kind of knowing what's happening, right? And knowing how your kid responds to stressors and things like that. Like when I think of like my daughter, like I can hear a tone in her voice where she's just like about to lose it. It's all becoming too much and she's really becoming overwhelmed, right? So I can hear that tone in her voice. And I think that's really individual. That's about like paying attention to our kids themselves, right? It may be paying attention to the words, but I think it's really more about, I think for most of us, it's about the sounds and that we hear that register as alarm versus, okay, could take a step back and pause. Yeah. Don't you think? I mean, you're working with kids all the time, right?
No, I agree. Cause there are definitely some children where it is, it's kind of like, I see like the yellow light is like, okay, I know this person's going to need support. I know this person, might go quicker to like the red light or quicker to like either name calling or hitting or getting physical or something like that. Definitely the tone and definitely body language definitely plays a part in it. And there are definitely some kids I've identified that like can still kind of get a little heated, but still stay within certain bounds. Mm-hmm. Like for me, as long as you're like not attacking the person in any way, I kind of like sit back and observe, like you're not name calling, you're not physically hurting someone, like you're able to use words, you're trying to like figure out what's going on. Really try to take a step back. And the other thing too is, I always tell my kids that, if you feel like you need help solving a problem, you can come to me and I will, help you kind of translate those words, right? And then that's when I'll do some of the noting you're talking about. Like, okay, so this happened, and then this happened. Because sometimes I don't know what happened, right? And I'm just trying to get like almost non-judgmentally kind of get the facts of what happened, and just kind of and noticing certain things that happen. And then usually, at some point, I kind of have enough information, and I can sometimes they need help coming up with the solution, but other times they don't. I try to, as much as possible, help them as little as possible, right?
Yeah.
Let them do as much heavy lifting as they can. But yeah, you're right. It's definitely knowing, where the child's at, what they're developmentally working on and what they can do. And I work with kids who are in a room who are vastly different developmental places, as kids as young as 5 to as old as 12, or who I'm mainly working with right now. And so obviously like the 10-year-old and the 5-year-old are going to have different skills. And not even just age, we have just, neurodivergent children who have different skills than the neurotypical. So yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying. You're just kind of knowing your kid and attuning to them and knowing what they need.
And that I just want to mention too, that, because I think I didn't mention it too, but like, as you described, like that sort of process of triage in a difficult moment, that whole process of describing or noting what's happening non-judgmentally, it's not just filling space. It's not just like filling airtime. It's name it to tame it, right? Dr. Dan Siegel coined that phrase. And the research has shown that literally does like help us regulate our emotions. It lowers the emotional temperature just to get this stuff non-judgmentally out in the air rather than all pent up in our bodies. Like somehow just describing is a really sort of simple and powerful tool that we're not used to using so much, because we're kind of used to like holding, I think, all our emotions in, I guess, and culturally, right? Like that's kind of more accepted, but it helps everything all around.
Yeah. And when you have like also kind of translating that language, like I think that's really powerful, and I think can be difficult to do and take a lot of practice. It takes us to kind of be able to change our own language with children. I think even the process of just like kind of almost repeating what they're saying, but using maybe more helpful language, is helping them learn to use more helpful language. And it's so amazing how, like, when you do that over and 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 over again, it makes that language start to become a part of their language too, right?
Yeah.
It'll be something like, this person is so mean, right? And me, especially if I know a little bit more about what happened and we're kind of, we've kind of talked about like what was happening, I may be able to translate that to say, you're feeling frustrated because you really want the turn right now and they're not finished with it. More times than not, they're like, yeah, I want it now. They're able to like, yeah, that is really like what is going on. That's really what's happening. Right. Mm-hmm. And even just to like kind of help them, and in that you hear the we're naming the emotion, we're processing like what's happening, and not judging you, not judging the other person. Mm-hmm. It's just you really want to turn right now and it's really hard for you to wait. And that puts the focus on like actually like going to solving the problem. Right. Like, okay, so now I can identify like, okay, I'm having a hard time waiting and I really want to turn. Now we can kind of put our focus more to, all right, like what do I do when I really want to turn? And it's really hard to wait.
It's almost like an external processing, right? Like it's like their brains are all still developing, and our humans take so long to develop like their brains fully, right? And so it's almost like we have the fully developed brain, so we're like the external processing system for like the kids.
Yeah, right. And then as we do that, like they get better at already kind of going in and solving the problem as they're using language. When they then eventually go up to the friend and say, I really want to turn and I don't, and I'm having a really hard time waiting for my turn, right? That's already, we're already like miles ahead. We're already like 5-10 minutes ahead. If we can start there, there's so much like that conflict gets resolved faster. We're able to actually, the other child has a shot at responding in maybe another helpful way, and actually responding, okay, you really want to turn, and saying, you can have a turn after I'm done, as opposed to them coming in a lot of times and saying, you're being mean, right? That's, the other child now then jumps to defensiveness, as even us adults a lot of times will jump to defensiveness when,
noticing that myself. Oh my God, the defensiveness. It's like, it's interesting. Like when you notice these things, like it's so deeply ingrained from my childhood. And I'm like, and then I'm like, oh, I'm like watching my 13-year-old. I'm like, oh, she's so defensive and driving me crazy. She can't just like own up to what she's doing. And then I'm like, oh yeah, that's because I'm so defensive still. Like it's still coming out that I'm so defensive. I'm like, oh, ding, ding, ding. Still learning all this stuff. It never stops.
You mentioned in the beginning that like you had a temper problem, and that's something that, you know, and obviously this is a different kind of environment and situation than when you are parenting your children. But, you know, that's not something that, like, you seem, even just for like the average person in average situations, you seem like you have such a calm demeanor and energy to you. Again, I'm sure if I asked your kids that they would, they'd be able to tell me some situations where you don't have that calm demeanor. But maybe help us out on like, what has kind of, and even in those moments when you're noticing you're getting defensive, like, what is your process for kind of calming your own nervous system down in the moment and actually having a response as opposed to just reacting with your emotions or your defensiveness?
I mean, it, of course, it all really depends on the situation. But yeah, I think the first step for me was always like just acknowledging that, yeah, I have this badass temper. And that's okay. Like, I'm not going to shame and blame myself for that. Like, that's part of being human. In fact, I kind of like worked it out of my system doing a lot of like artwork of like scary, like animal predators with, you know, like these thinking about like animal predators, how they have like, especially for women, like they have things like aggression or frustration and anger, but they don't have a problem with their frustration. Like pride of lionesses is just going to go take down those zebras. They don't have a problem with their aggression, right? Like that's part of what they need to be alive. And that's like part of our human, you know, what we have taken from our ancestors is this whole range of emotion. We don't need to. And what I learned, I guess I'm trying to say is that as I accepted that I have this, right? This is in me. It wasn't like something I signed up for. I wasn't like, oh, thank you, I would like a really intense temper. No, you know, it wasn't like something I chose or I wanted, right? But it's like something I have and it's part of being human. And when I can accept it, it's then it's kind of paradoxical. Once I'm like, oh, okay, hello, anger, old friend, I see you there, right? Then I'm able to work with it rather than like, there's a saying I like when that we want to walk with our shadow in front of us, right? So when our shadow is behind us, our shadow is like big, it's scary, we want to get away from it. And it's like, so it's like driving us.
Yeah.
And actually when we can walk with our shadow in front of us, we see it's there. We're not trying to make it go away, but it's something that we live with, we work with and we deal with, right? And then it becomes easier to deal with it. Like, I think, I forget who it is, they said, like Liz Gilbert said, like the fear sits in the back seat and they don't touch the radio on when you're driving the car, right? Like that's the idea, right? Is you kind of work with it. Yeah. And so for me, I think most of my learning comes from making mistakes. Like a lot of my learning comes from the mistakes I've made, right? Like when Maggie, who's now 16, was little, is like yelling at her and feeling terrible about it, right? And making that mistake and then letting that learning be really drive me to be my teacher. Okay, what do I need to learn from that? And like even now seeing this defensiveness that I've been like noticing in my daughter and then I notice in myself, I'm like, oh, okay. So what I'm trying to do is just, I'm trying to build that mindful awareness, right? Like to see clearly what's happening and say, oh, okay, there it is again, defensiveness. I think I'm trying to understand kind of where it comes from, right? To investigate it a little bit, recognize it, investigate it. And for me, I can see like I was like attacked as a kid when I had big feelings. And so I learned to be defensive. Like it was like, fight and fight back in my household, right? Like I learned how to fight a good fight and get the last word and all that stuff, right? So I learned that defensiveness really well. And so, okay, that's where it comes from. And then, so now my process is, now that I'm kind of working with that, is to say, okay, like how can I recognize it earlier in the timeline? How can I start to say, ooh, there it is. I'm recognizing it now as a thought, right? Like, oh, this is the, I want to be defensive right now. And it feels really hard not to be defensive, right? You know, that's part of the process, right? Is to be able to sit in the discomfort of, I have a habit energy. Right. I call these, I like, that's the term that my teacher Thich Nhat Hanh used, habit energy. And I love it because it's so non-judgmental, right? Like I have a habit energy of defensiveness. It comes from my ancestors and my upbringing, all this. And I can see, and when we don't follow the autopilot pattern of reactiveness, it feels so uncomfortable, right? It feels like wrong, or it feels like our cells are doing the wrong thing or something, right? It feels incredibly uncomfortable. And that's where the process of the practices of mindfulness really help, because then you can sit with the discomfort of like, oh, this is an uncomfortable, icky feeling, strange, and like as hard as, you know, like stopping your pee midstream or something, right? Like it's this hard, but I can be in this feeling and I'm not going to die. And I'm going to breathe and it's going to pass, you know, and that's part of like what mindfulness teaches us again and again and again, is that we can be in the discomfort of growing and learning something outside of our comfort zone, and we will just breathe through it and we will get past it, and then it will change again, right? It's that impermanence of everything is changing.
Do you have any like additional mindfulness tips for people, parents who feel, in particular, who feel kind of maybe touched out or overwhelmed by the noise level, or even just hugs, or even something I saw a post the other day of just like, you know, I feel rage when and irritated when I hear my children laughing, you know, and having a good time, and like that is. That's triggering to me. And that might be a little bit different than the being touched out thing, but I wonder if you have any additional mindfulness recommendations or tips, or kind of how to approach that with ourselves and with our families.
I mean, there's definitely a thread of continuity there. I mean, you can see it, right? And that is like, this, you know, if you're touched out, if you're feeling rage at kids being laughing, like what I'm kind of hearing there is that your internal stress level is really pretty high, right? And something's going on for you where your stress is so high that this little thing is like tipping you over. And touched out, I'm not trying to belittle it or something like that, because I've felt that, and like it just can be overwhelming. And I think kind of what that points to a bunch of different things. Points to A, I just want to acknowledge that like a bunch of stuff we have zero control over, right? Like in the United States, parents have it, like zero support, you know, as parents. Like if you know, my friend in the Netherlands had totally free, high quality childcare from the moment her child was born. And, you know, and even having the child wasn't as expensive, like all of those things. So we in the United States have a stress of a complete lack of social safety net support, right? Like, I think that's something that we have to acknowledge that affects us, that affects our parenting, that affects a generation of kids, like many generations of kids now, right? And then you can look at like overall stress. So sometimes, you know, parents ask me a lot, like, how do I stop yelling? And one of the big things is like our overall stress levels matter enormously. And sometimes we get in a cycle of, we don't want to pay attention to it, right? Like we want to scroll through Instagram, or we want to look at TikTok or whatever. We want to distract ourselves so that we're not paying attention to the discomfort of the stress in our lives, right? And it's a coping mechanism that can be effective in a short run, but ultimately it leaves us with kind of weak coping muscles in some ways, like in that when we have to actually, like that's what I'm, you know, mindfulness teaches us, that we have to be aware of the problem before we're going to be able to do anything about it, right? So if we are getting, you know, I would take those two situations differently. Like if we're like getting triggered by our kids' laughter, A, I would say like, you know, what are you feeling in your body? What does that feel like? Why do you think you feel like that? Like, can you investigate it? Is there something from your upbringing, right? Is there something that you want to, that this moment, because our emotions are are messengers. This is something I talk about in Raising Good Humans every day, actually. Like, we want to think of them, these, it's like a messenger that's teaching you, that saying that you're out of balance somewhere. So what is this messenger telling you, right? That this laughter is making you feel so upset, and what is your overall stress like? And then to look at the things that connect them. If you're being touched out, are you, like, again, lack of safety net? Like, maybe a human being is in a room with a child for way too long, right? We did not evolve to have one or two human beings raise these small humans, because they're crazy making for the vast majority of us. Yeah. If you spend that much time with them, right? Like, are you getting breaks? And it's hard for me to ask these questions because I know that, you may have like three jobs. You may have to stay, you know, there's so many circumstances that I don't know, right? But like, parents deserve breaks. Yeah, parents deserve to give themselves permission to take a break, to be themselves, to have breathing space. Your relationship with your child is just like every other relationship in that you need breathing space. And your child may want to touch you all the time. And if you don't want that, that's okay. And it's okay for you to hold those boundaries and say, right now, that's actually like great modeling healthy boundaries. But it's also okay for then you to say, let me see if I can find some, you know, call mom or find some childcare or tag out with my partner or go to the YMCA and put them in childcare and go for a walk for an hour, right? Like, sometimes we don't even give ourselves permission to take that break because we feel like we have to be so connected and on with our kids. So yeah. There's a lot there, but I think it's pointing to like those larger circumstances that we do need to be aware of and acknowledge.
Okay. Let me shift gears back to kind of the book, or at least the book title, as we're kind of getting towards the end here. And it's a big question, but I think we got a little bit of time. What makes a good human?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah.
You know, I when I think about that, like, I think of my daughters, right? Like, what do I want for them? And ultimately, what I want for them is I want them to feel comfortable in their own skin. You know, I want them to, because there's going to be so many challenges in life. And if they can feel comfortable in their own skin, they can take on any challenge. Because if they have the foundation of steadiness in their heart and mind, then they can solve whatever problems come around their way. And so that's kind of what, that's why, I mean, I think there's a lot of focus from a lot of us, like you and myself, and many of us are part of a movement that are really paying attention to social, emotional learning, right? Like the foundation of understanding ourselves and being comfortable with ourselves and seeing that, yeah, that's creates a foundation for everything you're doing in your life, you know? So I guess, yeah, for me, it all kind of sums up to being comfortable in your own skin. But then part of it is when we think about like the skillful communication pieces and like how we hold boundaries, right? From like a mindful parenting perspective is also having awareness and consciousness about how you are with other people, right? Because we like my feelings, you feel my feelings, I feel your feelings, you know what I mean? Like we can change our emotional states and affect each other. Human beings are like the most social creatures on the planet. We inter-are. And so when we can feel comfortable in our own skin, but also then recognize how our behaviors and how our actions affect others and be able to communicate with others. Like those two things, like if my kids can see and understand and feel comfortable with them and themselves and have empathy, have awareness of what's going on with others, of how their behaviors affect others, then I think is for me what I would say a good human is. Does that make sense?
So yeah, what I'm getting is, if I were to try to condense it in one sentence, a good human is someone who has awareness of self and awareness of others.
Yeah. Yeah. Compassion and awareness. I would say both of those things. Compassion,
awareness for yourself and others.
Definitely. You got it. Nice, okay. Nice little summary definition there, Chaz.
So what makes a bad human?
Well, I guess then you're going to like the opposite, right? Is the complete lack of awareness of yourself, complete lack of awareness of how things affect others and things like that. I mean, if we look at some of the most unskillful humans out there, there's a real lack of awareness. And a lot of the challenges I see in the world from like some of the most painfully horrible players in the world, I look at and I think, oh my gosh, they need to be able to process their difficult feelings. It's like all comes from this. It's all there. I'm like at the news and I'm like,
I know. I see it from that lens all the time as well. Especially we talk not just and compassion for others, 100%. It's definitely something that we need to improve on. And I think, you know, your book's called Raising Good Humans. You know, can you speak a little bit on just kind of the expectations? Because someone may look at their child, and I'm looking at my 6-year-old or my 5-year-old, and I'm seeing plenty of examples where they're not aware of their self and their self and others, and might show lack of compassion. Can you share a little bit about your perspective on kind of expectations in that process? And I'd also like to, if you could just share, because I feel like this is something we're just going to start asking all my podcast episodes just to see where people are at, what your perspective on kind of consequences. And I mean, you have a teen now, so like, can you just share a little bit about your philosophy on consequences, and then also share a little bit about expectations and the process of people becoming more compassionate and aware?
Sure. Yeah. Actually, I think I talk about expectations like a number of times in Raising Good Humans every day, because our expectations are generally way too high for little kids, right? Yeah. Way too high. They're, and babies, sometimes our expectations are really high for babies, I think. You know, we need to somehow, I don't know how we got this way, but like somehow we think like a kid's gonna, we're gonna say something once. Why do I have to repeat myself, right? Like we're gonna say something once and then a kid's gonna just be like, yes, mother, whatever you say, you know, like, no, like even adults need lots of repetition when they're learning something. And so kids are like way, way less developed brains. So they're going to need a lot of repetition. I think we need to think of discipline as learning, right? As teaching. Like the root of the word discipline is disciplinus, which is also the root of the word disciple, right? Someone to follow a teacher. And I think that's a really helpful way to think about it, right? Because we're modeling and our kids are following our modeling ways of being. And if we can think about parenting in a lot of ways as teaching, like all, you know, our kids are going to mess up all the time. Like, and that's fine. They're supposed to, you know, like they're supposed to make mistakes, and that's okay. It's, you know, we have to give ourselves permission to be human, and we have to give our kids permission to be human, permission to be kids. But then we can take those mistakes and let them be their teachers. Like, oh, you spilled that like bright blue juice all over the floor. Okay, this is what we have to do to clean it up, right? Like, this is what we have to do. When I think about consequences, you know, I think that, you know, it's interesting because I know from the research, you know, and my own experience that things like power, things that when we use power over our kids, like punishments and threats, things that we hold out to, you know, I'm going to take away your screen time, that kind of thing, to make them do what we want, right? We know that doesn't, it can kind of work in the moment, but we know it actually creates more resentment in the long run and actually undermines our kids' desire to want to cooperate with us, and it undermines our influence as well. We lose influence. Like by the time our kids might be teens, we might have lost influence. So now my kids are teens, and I never would have thought this. Like, I actually on a little tangent here, but I actually remember when my second daughter was born, I went on the first walk around the neighborhood that I'd ever gone on with this like newborn baby, and we met this family that had moved in, and we talked to them, and somehow I talked to them about parenting, and they said, "Oh yeah, they don't use timeouts," and I was like shocked and appalled, and I was like, "My child will not run rampant across my house. That's bananas. That's crazy." But then I've learned so much, of course, since then, and know how like a timeout actually isn't very helpful. Like if a kid's dysregulated, it's like the very opposite of what they need, right? And that punishments actually can make kids a little less likely to cooperate with you. And now my daughters are 16 and 13. I've never used punishments. I mean, I have used power sometimes, like I have, but I've never used punishments like timeouts or grounding or things like that. And it has gotten easier and easier over time as time goes on. And as teenagers, they do cooperate with me. We have discussions about things, right? I haven't had to ramp up the punishments as like happens kind of, and there has been no teen rebellion. Like, yeah, I get teen attitude, but like sometimes, you know, but then we go through that, right? And we actually have good relationships where we are pretty connected. And so I think that like there can, and you know, we do need to hold boundaries for kids. Like we can and should. I mean, I'm known in my house as being the hard ass, right? But we don't have to manufacture them, you know? It may be that like, you know, if you borrow this thing of your, take this thing of your sister's and mess it up, your sister's not going to want to let you borrow their stuff anymore. And yeah, well, that's what happened. Right. It may be like, so one of the places that I find challenging to hold boundaries, which everybody does, is screen time, because it's designed to be like addictive and by the smartest minds in the country. Right. But yeah, at the same time, like we've had those conversations and we talked to them about it and we've held those boundaries. And there have been times where we said, okay, like you didn't abide by the rules that we both agreed on, so we're not going to have that device tomorrow. Maybe we'll try it again. And the next day, like that's like a natural consequence in my mind. Right. But it wasn't like we didn't like manufacture a big thing or shame them or blame them for their mistakes. So I think I'm rambling a little here, Chaz, but I think this is all to say that it's the research, you know, even though our traditions tell us that we have to like hurt kids to make them behave, or we have to make them afraid to make them respectful, the research says that's not true. And my experience, my personal experience and working with like hundreds of people in mindful parenting has really shown that that's not true. Like actually, these are relationships. We can think about discipline as teaching, right? What do our kids need to learn in these moments? And that's really what we want to get to the heart of the matter with.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your information, your knowledge, and your wisdom, and your experience with us. Raising Good Humans Every Day. Where can we find it? Where does it, is it available right now? Or is it available like,
August
26th.
So, then in a couple of days, it comes out August 1st. So actually, if you want a copy, Raising Good Humans Every Day, 50 Simple Ways to Press Pause, Stay Present, and Connect with Your Kids, pre-order it now. Like go to your local bookseller or Amazon or whatever and pre-order, because that's like an awesome thing to do to support a book. So if you're going to buy it later, get it like right away. And I'll be like,
yeah.
What's my name?
Mr.
What's my name?
Mr.
What's my